our attorney said, hey, just consider it patient choice and don't talk about it. Just put a little list on their bed of what nursing homes they can choose or what home health agencies they can choose and let them pick. Don't say anything. And literally that's how hospitals did it. That's silly. That's inane. And you really see that when it's your mom or your grandmother that needs care. And you say to the case manager or social worker, hey, what would you do if you were in my shoes? And they kind of say, well, I'm not really supposed to say. And you go, whose dumb rule is that, right? Yep. So once the Affordable Care Act changed, and a minute ago, remember we were talking about discharge with dignity. We talked about financial incentives change. So now the hospital is in some way, shape, or form financially responsible for where they send patients afterwards. So when I saw that happen, I said, hey, good news. We can stop being silly about how we handle this and we can have an educated conversation with the patient and the family about what's best for this patient, which post-acute provider's best. Tell them they have a right to go home. And I know you've had several guests on your show from CMS, from Medicare, and without fail, every time I've talked to anybody that works for Medicare, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, they always say the same thing. You guys are all overreacting to this. You need to have an educated conversation. That's all we want. And that's what they've always said.
This is Gavin Ward, co-host of Pop Health Podcast. In today's episode, Dr. Josh Luke visited our home studio in El Segundo, California. Some of you listening in may know the name Dr. Josh Luke, as he is one of the nation's first healthcare futurists, which is a term that is often used for folks who are experts in healthcare strategy. Dr. Luke was a former hospital CEO who made the decision to go out on his own and become an entrepreneur and start the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative back in early this decade, and also is now an established author and writer for folks like Forbes. We hope you enjoyed today's show, which talks a lot about transitional care and the future of healthcare. If you do like the show, feel free to leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher, and feel free to reach out to myself or co-host Zach Morgan as well by visiting the site pophealthpodcast.com. Thanks everyone, and enjoy the show. Josh, tell us something about you that would surprise the audience. Maybe something outside of healthcare, something on the personal side.
It's always the toughest question. You know, this summer I noticed that all the gray in my salt and pepper beard was on my chin. And so one day I just shaved all the hair off my chin. And most of you who know me know I've had a goatee for years. It's just part of my wardrobe. So next thing I knew, I looked in the mirror and I had, I guess, what people call handlebars or a chopper mustache, which I think you have to be a policeman, a fireman, a baseball player, or a biker to wear those choppers. And so I took a couple pictures and posted them online the next couple weeks. And people started saying, hey, you look like Hulk Hogan. I like it. And then nice. So finally the summer came to an end and I just said, it's so uncomfortable. I got to shave it. But so many people were like sending me one-liners from Hulk Hogan. Yeah. I thought it was pretty funny. So it was a fun summer growing a different mustache there for a while. I looked up on Google the actual name, Gavin. It's called a horseshoe mustache. Oh. But people refer to it as the Hulk Hogan style mustache.
So. Nice, man. Well, I grew up born in 1980, so I know those 80s wrestlers. And yes, I see that, man.
Some about 24-inch pythons. I don't know. I can never nail the line, but people just said, add those to your biceps and you'll be good to go.
Nice. My member is, eat your vitamins, say your prayers, brother.
Yeah,
that one. Speaking of summer, we're recording this towards the end of summer. How was your summer? You go anywhere with your family?
Yeah, Gavin, you know, I'm a big boat guy. I head out to the river a lot, Colorado River, for those of you who aren't familiar on the west region here. But we go out to Lake Powell every summer. We got a houseboat timeshare out there. It's on the border of Arizona and Utah, north rim of the Grand Canyon. I just came back from there, and it's really God's country. It's a great place. Go out there every summer with my kids. And this year I got three in high school. So, you know, those family vacations, it's not up to mom and dad if you have those anymore after high school. You can invite the kids, but you never know if they're going to come. So it was a great summer for that.
Nice, man. Well, glad you had a good time with your family. You were still on email. I remember you said, hey, I'm going to take a little vacation, might get back to you, but you still responded a couple times. So thank you very much. For those of you that don't know, Josh Luke has done quite a bit in healthcare. And why don't we take a step back, Josh, and tell us a little bit about you growing up, where you grew up, and how you got into healthcare.
Yeah, so I'm a Southern California guy, and I have a really unorthodox career path, but it's been one that's been rewarding, and it's been a real blessing. You know, I had two older brothers that were professional athletes, and I remember sitting on the bench watching my high school basketball team play one day, and sitting on the bench was a key phrase there, thinking, gosh, you know, maybe I should consider a different profession other than what my brothers did, because maybe I'm not gifted in the same way they are. And so I set my sights on working in sports marketing to stay close to sports, which I love so much. And so through my bachelor's degree in grad school, that's what I wanted to do. And by the time I graduated grad school, Gavin, down here at Cal State Fullerton, I had probably within a year with the marketing agencies I worked for all four major sporting, professional sports organizations, as well as the PGA Tour, and volunteered for some other different events that were awesome. And so I was really living my dream. But somewhere in that path, I got married, and I just realized in 1998, right after I got married, I woke up literally the next morning after I got married and said, something's changed. And it was just that sports didn't mean that much to me anymore, that preparing myself to be a husband and a father was a bigger priority. So I started looking for a different career path. And within a few months, between my grandmother's care plan, between her not being able to afford the basic things she needed, and between the lack of communication and her caregivers, I started to venture towards healthcare. And then one of my students at the university I was teaching at let me know about an opening in a nursing home for a director of marketing and admissions. And I went and interviewed, got the job, and asked them if they'd make me an administrator in training. So within a couple of years of really reaching the pinnacle of sports marketing, I was representing some really famous athletes for a while there as their marketer. I was a nursing home administrator, and that was a big leap, but it's turned out to be really rewarding.
Nice. I didn't even know what AIT stood for. Most of the folks who listen in are healthcare professionals, and probably by now many of you know what AIT is, but administrator in training. So for those of you that walk the SNFs or the skilled nursing facilities, you might see some young leaders there called AITs, and yep. Josh went through that as well. So you became a SNF or skilled nursing facility administrator, and how did you end up becoming a hospital CEO?
You know, it was really, you know, a lot of times people joke that the definition of luck is when preparation meets opportunity. And whether it was luck or just my preparation, you know, I had a PhD by the time I was 32, because I always thought I wanted to be a leader, and I wanted to be prepared when that opportunity came. And as I was running nursing homes, I got a call from a vendor, actually, somebody that served the post-acute and the acute. And they said, hey, there's a small aging hospital in the city of Anaheim, and their leadership has been through three or four leaders in the last couple of years. And the nursing homes across the street have lost confidence in them. They are now putting patients in ambulances and driving right by and going to the hospital only about a half a mile away, but still it's competition, right? So they were actually looking for a nursing home administrator to run their hospital. And even though that sounds like a big leap, it was a small hospital, it was an aging hospital, and they had a second campus nearby that had a nursing home and a psychiatric unit, which were both things I was experienced in. So they offered me the job, and I didn't even know until I was in the interview that it was as the CEO. And when I found that out, of course I wanted the job. And I asked them very specifically to give me three or four goals that I could work for, because I wasn't that naive to think, wow, my first job ever in a hospital is going to be as its CEO. But almost all four of those goals, all of them were volume-based. And I was able, Gavin, to blow three of those out of the water, one of them within 30 days and two of them within 90 days. So I was actually there 4 years, and I left on my own because the hospital across town in Anaheim, which is now called Anaheim Global Regional Medical Center, offered me to be their CEO, and I did that for three more years too. So it was an unconventional leap. I really learned on the job, but that's really who shaped the guy I am today, that questions everything, that founded the Readmission Collaborative. And all the things you're going to hear about in the next half hour are things that really were shaped by the fact that I learned on the job and asked a lot of questions.
Nice, Josh. You got through that very efficiently. That's very good. I've known Josh for about 6 years, so I know most of this story to be up front, and that was pretty cool to kind of...
That was the short version.
That was a real short version. Well done. And some of you who are listening may know Josh's story, but those who haven't, if you'd like to learn more, feel free to see Josh. He's out and about, and we'll talk more about how to contact him and his website. So one thing you mentioned, Josh, was the Readmission Collaborative. I believe you're referring to the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative. Is that right?
That's correct.
And so I first knew of Josh when he was a vice president at Torrance Memorial down in the South Bay portion of the Los Angeles area. And, you know, I hadn't had the chance to meet him. I had worked with some of their case management folks there, and like, we got to meet Josh. You know, he's innovative. We got to get his buy into these new initiatives. And I think right before we were to have the chance to meet in that role, you transitioned over and created the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative. So tell us
how you got that started, why you got that started.
Yeah, great lead in too, Gavin. So, you know, Torrance Memorial Health System is an awesome system here in Los Angeles County, a not-for-profit. And I had been the CEO for, I think, 7 or 8 of the prior 10 years for Safety Net Hospitals, which really served the neediest of the needy, aging seniors, those with chronic diseases, those with multiple comorbidities, as well as the psychiatric community, both adult and senior. So I really came from a servant leader type background, where at Torrance, I was now a VP, one of 8 vice presidents in the room. I was over post-acute. And looking back, and even then, it was a real blessing to be given the title vice president of post-acute. And I always joke, before that was cool. I was one of the first in the country to get that title, but I was really well positioned to do it because of the background we've talked about for the last 10 minutes or so. So what happened down there is I was there, and all of a sudden, about 1.5 years after the Affordable Care Act passed, I love to speak, and I was out there speaking at events, and I said, well, nobody seems to know anything about this new hospital readmission penalty. And so as I started researching it, I found that not only did not many people know, Gavin, but people didn't want to know. They kind of shied away from it. And so I contacted the American College of Healthcare Executives after one of their executives had seen me speak and said, hey, you bring a really good perspective on this. You should consider writing a book. And I said, hey, why don't we do that? So I wrote a book through their academic press called Readmission Prevention, Solutions Across the Provider Continuum. It ended up being their bestseller in 2015. But what happened as soon as I contracted to do that in 2013 is I said, man, I'm just one dude in Southern California that has seen a lot from the nursing home side and the hospital side. And somewhere in that journey, I'd also overseen a home health, a hospice, and an acute rehab. Most of that at Torrance, but some of it at a Health South rehab facility. So I'd seen almost all the post-acute levels of care, as well as running a hospital. So I did bring a really unique perspective. But what I was honest with myself about is, hey, people are going to want more perspectives than yours. So why don't you create a portal, an online portal, where anybody in the country, whether it's a non-medical home care company, a nursing home, a hospital, or a doctor, even a vendor, could submit a case study for free and share with me what they've done to coordinate care or prevent hospital readmissions. Because remember, if we turn the clock back to 2011 and 12, Gavin, guys like you and I, who are now thought as thought leaders on this stuff nationally, we never even heard of readmission prevention. It wasn't even on our radar in 2010. And now here we are, I mean, it's 2018 now, but even as early as 2014 and 15, if I were to put together a list of the top 20 people in the country on readmission prevention and care coordination who had invested in understanding, you and I were both on that list. And that's a compliment to both of us, but it gets to this point. I'm not just here to stroke both their egos. What I want to say is this.
Okay? I wasn't expecting anything.
Yeah. What I wanted to say is this. The reason people didn't invest in it is because it's punitive.
Yeah.
And I felt that in my jobs. The hospital gets paid for putting a head in a bed. Even in value-based care, the hospital gets paid for putting a head in a bed. 85% of their revenue is still about putting a head in a bed. And when they do that efficiently, they're going to get some reward on the backside. But most of them were so entrenched. I learned how to be a CEO on the job. You know what I learned? Put a head in a bed. You know, contract with insurers. Go talk to doctors. Open the floodgates. Let them come in. Put a head in a bed and everybody wins. That's how you get paid. So to this date in 2018, I don't know a single hospital that has ever paid a penny to keep a head out of a bed. Now, there are hospitals that have paid to improve care coordination, that have paid to pay more attention to what's happening post-discharge, which even that's tough for them because they still don't get paid for that for the most part, right? But when I started the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative, which you can find online, it's the first 3 words there. They're long words, but you know them all. NationalReadmissionPrevention.com. It was to gather case studies from around the country for free so we could all create just a high-level thinking chat room where we could all exchange ideas. And it's still up. It's still free. And the website is now a not-for-profit. It's been an awesome experience and it served its purpose because it helped me write that book, which later became a bestseller.
Yeah, very cool, Josh. Yeah, I remember even myself took a little class that you offered.
Yeah, so there's 2 of them actually. And I'm glad you said that because there's some changes coming up on that. So you were the first ever to be certified in readmission prevention as a fellow.
Yep.
For organizations that have franchises or teams, they do that same program, but as a team, it's more of a group activity.
Okay.
We also did a bundled payment certification, which you also completed. I think Zach, your co-host, completed as well. And as I am pivoting towards 2019, one of the things I'm doing, actually going to update those programs to include CEUs. CEUs for nursing home administrators, CEUs for case managers, social workers, anything that I think somebody in your seat or somebody else's seat who knows that they could benefit from being a readmissions expert, I'm going to try to give them the opportunity to say, hey, if I got to pay $200, $300, or $400 a year to do CEUs anyway, I might as well do it through the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative, the not-for-profit site, where I also get this cool seal that's on my business card. And for those of you who follow the Pop Health Podcast, you see it on Gavin's signature. There's a seal down there that says, hey, readmission certified. And I can guarantee you, if you're not the most knowledgeable person in your market on readmissions after you're done with that, you're definitely in the top three.
Very good. Well, thanks, Josh. I knew you'd give a shout out on what you have available for folks out there today. So you went from having probably a well-paying career, stable job, salaried job, to, in a sense, being an entrepreneur with the creation of the NRPC and some of the work that you're doing. Briefly, how was that transition for you?
It was tough. And I think anybody who was raised in corporate America, as much as you want to be an entrepreneur, it can be scary. And it continues to be scary, but it also continues to be rewarding. I'm going to transition to Josh Luke, the quote-unquote semi-life coach for 20 seconds here. But there's two books that shaped me long before I made that transition. And they're old books, but they're funny books. Not funny, but they're The Millionaire Next Door. It's just basic principles on how to save money and retain wealth. And then the other one was, most of you have heard of it, it's Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Yeah.
And Rich Dad in particular pounds your head over and over saying you must be an entrepreneur, you have to be an entrepreneur. You know, the things you learn, the longer you're in corporate America, the harder it is to do. And that book really impacted me. And I read it probably 5 to 7 years before I went out on my own, but it shaped me and gave me time to prepare for that. So being an entrepreneur is incredibly rewarding, but there's also many nights where you wake up and say, hey, how am I going to feed my family next month or next year?
I was going to say, I believe you're the primary provider. I know you have a lovely wife and children at home. So when you talk to the missus and let her know that you're going to go out on your own. How was that conversation, if you mind me asking?
You know, praise God for this, Gavin, but it smacked me over the head. It's funny because a couple of my mentors said, you've been saying you want to be an entrepreneur for years and you just had this event for your not-for-profit National Readmission Prevention Collaborative. You sold it out in 2 weeks. You had it again 3 months later in Anaheim. You had 600 people. Maybe it's time. And actually, I'd already been talking to the CEO down at Torrance, and the project that he had hired me for, we had finished, and we weren't really sure which of the next projects we were going to work on. But I said, hey, would this be a good time for me to maybe step out and work on some stuff from the outside if you still needed me? So the timing was good. It was a real blessing. And for me, it was a little different than most entrepreneurs because you got to save up that runway. Well, I was able actually to, as a side hustle, if you will, have an event really when I was trying to gather information for this book, which put enough money in my pocket to go out on my own. And I'm very grateful for that and for the partners like your organization that made that happen back in the day.
So the missus was okay. No pushback.
Yeah. I would say no pushback, but needless to say, I had more answers than questions. So,
well, good for you, Josh. So we're going to learn more about Josh's work and where he is today after we take a short break. Okay, everyone, welcome back from the break. So we've heard from Josh, heard about the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative and how he got that off the ground and had the courage to do so. So as part of his work with what I'll refer to as the NRPC over the years, also the National Readmission and Bundled Payment Collaborative, or did I get that right,
yep,
Josh?
Yep.
Okay.
They're two different entities, but NRPC and the National Bundled Payment Collaborative.
Great. So as you were doing that work, you also came out with something called Discharge with Dignity. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's actually probably one of the bright spots in my career and the most proud things that I've done, Gavin, because what happened is at the end of 2015, as I was being sought after all over the country to speak on care coordination readmission prevention, I finished kind of a national tour with 15 events. You and your company, 24-Hour Home Care, were there and really were on the forefront with me of just discovering, sharing, being willing to talk about our experiences, really just kind of a high-level think tank of how we can do this better. I was challenged by several people to bring something new in 2016. And they said, hey, I've seen you speak 3 or 4 times, and my favorite thing are the new things. You're always ahead of it. You always know what's coming. And more importantly, not just the legislation we can all read about, but how it's going to impact providers, whether it's a hospital, a nursing home, a post-acute provider in the home, or even you as an individual. And so I challenged myself in December of 2015 to come up with some tools that I didn't want people to say Josh knows all the problems, but he doesn't have the answer. So I came up with two tools, and one of them I call my purple guide. It's just a purple chart of everything that Medicare covers. That you can really, if you go to the emergency room, it's a purple chart of everywhere a patient can go from the emergency room and be covered by Medicare. And that's a really helpful tool for those in the emergency room and post-acute providers. But the one that really stuck is what a lot of people refer to as my rainbow guide, which is the discharge with dignity. And I had really become passionate about the fact that patients deserve to go home from the hospital. And remember, I'm a nursing home administrator and preceptor by trade. And preceptor simply means I'm approved to train other administrators. But I really changed, my perspective changed a lot when my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, as you know, which was in 2010. But really, the effects started to really be prevalent in 2014, 2015. So by the end of 15, I said, doggone it, I was brainwashed when I was running hospitals and nursing homes that if a patient had Medicare, to send them to a nursing home and not to tell them they had options and not really to explore those other options or communicate with them, to the point, Gavin, that I joke that when I was trained in the nursing home, I was told never to use the term convalescent. And I really thought about why that was. And the reason is really obvious, because every Gen Xer promised their parents that we would never send them to a convalescent home. And I believe that to be true. And I've gone on the record with that. Nobody taught me that. I didn't read anywhere. I wrote it everywhere I can write it, because I believe that to be true. And nowadays, now that people know what a nursing home is, you know, we call it things like express rehab or something like that, because we're trying to move the cheese and change the name. So the long answer to your question is the Discharge with Dignity Guide was a guide I developed for social workers and case managers to help them understand that not only does every patient in America prefer to age and heal in their home, but now the financial incentives of the reimbursement model, federal government's reimbursement model, Medicare, by the way, every insurer has always been this way, but now Medicare is aligned, incentivize everybody, including the hospital, financially, to send the patient directly home when it's appropriate. And so the last thing I'll say about Discharge with Dignity is, well, let me say two more things. Now in my speeches, Gavin, I ask the audience to raise their hand if they can't wait for the day that they personally get to be admitted to a convalescent home for the rest of their lives.
I steal that line all the time.
Yeah, and please do, because it's so impactful. It is so impactful because nobody raises their hand.
Yeah.
And they know when I'm done and they chuckle, they go, uh-oh, he just set us up. Because what we've all done in the fee-for-service era, which, as you know, I refer to as the fee-for-service free-for-all, because there were no checks and balances. Everybody could be sent to a nursing home and nobody could question it. What we've done now is say, hey, do you want to go there? No, nobody does. So not only do Americans not want to go there, but now there's no financial incentive to do it. So I developed a guide for social workers and case managers to help them understand and to reiterate that their organization, their hospital, their health system is now financially responsible for at least a portion of every day that patient spends in a post-acute institution.
Very good, Josh. Thanks for sharing about Discharge with Dignity. So that was 2015. You came up with the idea. You challenged yourself. You put it out in 2016. It's now trademarked. Tell us about the trademark process briefly. Was that pretty easy?
No, not at all. Even for my attorney, it wasn't easy, you know. So let me tell you a brief story to just kind of wrap up this Discharge with Dignity, because I think for your audience, this is probably one of the most critical things we're talking about that can help them understand what's changed since the Affordable Care Act passed and how it relates to a trademark. I presented this for the first time as the keynote speaker for the Case Management Society of America in 2016 annual meeting in Long Beach. Gavin, you guys were there. I was there. 2,000 case managers running around. And their former leader introduced me by saying, we know he's controversial. The first two or three times that we heard Josh, we got a little anxiety. But the third time we went, my goodness, our role as trade organizations is to help our members understand all of the considerations, all of the possibilities, and I applaud CMSA for being willing to do that. They brought Dr. Eric Coleman and myself in to be the co-keynote speakers. I presented this guide, and I just, even in the last few months, have heard from the former leader, Sherry Latimer, who said, man, did we hear about it after you spoke? But then the ratings came in, and you got a 94% good or very good on your presentation, and you got 7 or 8 requests to be the speaker at national meeting or at statewide meetings that year. But the pushback I got was because, as a CEO even, I was always getting pushback in terms of, hey, stay out of discharge planning. That's our role, because there were federal laws about that. But let me tell you a cool story to wrap this up, because the trademark took about a year and the attorneys had to deal with it. But the trademark was as a result of this. I was in Ohio And a lady walks up to me that I didn't recall meeting with a big smile. I was the keynote speaker at one of the case management trade organs. I think it was a different, it was ACMA this time, American Case Management Association. But she came up to me with a smile and she shoved this little button, one of those old school 99 cent, you know, 1980s rock and roll buttons in my face. And it was a blue button that said, "Why not home? Mercy Health."
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. And she said, "Hey, you inspired me in Long Beach." And I said to her, "I don't know you, but can I have that button? Because I'm going to steal it from you if you don't give it to me, right?" And so she gave it to me and I wrote her name down. It's Julie Allen. She's with Mercy Health. And I said, "Hey, I want to keep up with you. I want to communicate with you because I think I want to start using Why Not Home as the name of my presentation, even Absolutely. Though Discharge with Dignity is the trademark, because I wanted a catchy name, but your name goes straight to the point." What a rewarding experience that was. Now, Gavin, I'll put a little plug for the not-for-profit NRPC here. For case management associations, for social work, for any healthcare association that hires me to come speak, which, by the way, is what I do for a living, okay, I now give buttons to them in addition to books.
Oh, nice.
That say "Why Not Home" with the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative logo on it. So it's a really cool thing.
Cool. Julie, hope you get a little pat on
Julie
the
back. Julie Allen. Mercy Allen. There you go.
You may not get a formal royalty, but at least you got a shout out. Very good. Well, thanks for that inspiration, Julie Allen in Ohio. We're getting towards the end of the show, and we want to talk a little bit about where you are today. So, but before we do that, you mentioned there's federal laws with case managers and you're controversial, which I'm really glad you self-aware.
Better that I say that than you.
Yeah. So steering or non-steering, tell us about not what a hospital policy is, but what are the laws with regard to steering towards, first, insurance reimbursed or Medicare reimbursed services? What are the laws, generally speaking, there? And then what are the steering laws for non-medical home care, assisted living, if there are any?
So, Gavin, you and I joke that I'm kind of controversial by design, and the initial kind of controversy that I created as an outspoken person from the healthcare industry was that I believed firmly there was a difference between patient choice and steering. You know, I still believe that the difference between patient steering and choice is significant, and I think the rest of the country's seen that. I think I was probably one of the first to say it, but now most are there. And what's interesting, Gavin, is this: the rules on the federal guidelines haven't changed, right? They haven't changed at all. What has changed is I, as a hospital CEO, always pay my attorney, just like we all pay attorneys, to tell us to take the high road, to be safe, to be smart, so we don't get in trouble. So back in the 90s, when patient steering was an issue, our attorney said, "Hey, just consider it patient choice and don't talk about it. Just put a little list on their bed of what nursing homes they can choose or what home health agencies they can choose and let them pick. Don't say anything." And literally, that's how hospitals did it. That's silly. That's inane. And you really see that when it's your mom or your grandmother that needs care. And you say to the case manager or social worker, "Hey, what would you do if you were in my shoes?" And they kind of say, "Well, I'm not really supposed to say." And you go, "Whose dumb rule is that?" Right? Yep. So once the Affordable Care Act changed, and a minute ago, remember we were talking about Discharge with Dignity. We talked about financial incentives change. So now the hospital is in some way, shape, or form financially responsible for where they send patients afterwards. So when I saw that happen, I said, "Hey, good news. We can stop being silly about how we handle this, and we can have an educated conversation with the patient and the family about what's best for this patient, which post-acute provider's best, tell them they have a right to go home." And I know you've had several guests on your show from CMS, from Medicare, and without fail, every time I've talked to anybody that works for Medicare, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, they always say the same thing. You guys are all overreacting to this. You need to have an educated conversation. That's all we want. And that's what they've always said. So now the rules haven't changed, but now that hospitals are financially on the hook, the attorneys are pointing to the same exact legislation and say, "No, we interpret it this way. Now, you are allowed to soft steer if appropriate and have an educated conversation. Just don't do it inappropriately." And in defense of those who told us to take the high road, that's why they initially said that. They basically were saying, "We're trying to weed out the bad guys here, so let's just play it safe and not talk about it at all." Nowadays, the good news is most states have passed a Care Plan Act, which requires social workers and case managers to talk to families about their options and to let them know they have the right to go home anytime they want.
Great. And then so for federally reimbursed services, that kind of follows what most of what you shared. What about services like assisted living, non-medical home care? Are there steering laws that are applied to those?
Yes and no. I mean, the bottom line is that case managers and social workers, is, you know, when I had them reporting to me, they looked at it all one and the same. The laws are much more strict when they're Medicare patients. When you're going from one Medicare approved facility like a hospital to another, which is a nursing home. But when it's cash pay, which would be non-medical home care assisted living, it's a little looser, but people didn't really interpret it that way. I'll tell you, Gavin, you and I have been outspoken proponents. I won't say advocates of this, but proponents of this for a long time, because we wanted people to explore it and agree with us because we believed we were correct. I hope you don't mind me speaking for you. But what's happened it now is we've been so successful over 5 years in doing that. I've actually had people come up to me and say that post-acute institutions, which would be nursing homes, I've actually heard it more about the acute rehabs, are saying, hey, you have a right to be institutionalized after care, because our message has gotten really reversed in the last 5 years, where we felt strongly people weren't being told they had a right to go home. Now they're being told that so prevalently that people feel like it's okay to market to them that, hey, but you also have a right to be institutionalized.
Wow. Yeah. That's the first
kind of knows we're winning the battle, huh?
It does. That's interesting. That's the first time I've heard that. And I'm guessing a lot of listeners may not have heard that as well. So thank you for sharing a little bit about steering. So two other topics I want to hit on before we end the show. One is technology. There's a lot of tech companies out there. You've had many partners support you at your conferences, your various initiatives. One of the things I've seen out there is a lack of actually adoption of the technology. It sounds great, but it requires work. It requires effort by either the provider or the patient to engage with the technology. And to be upfront, I haven't seen a lot of successful technology because of that lack of engagement and that human element. Can you tell us a little bit about your perspective on technology?
Yeah, and I think it also meshes well into the one thing I wanted to say about the last question, which is you asked about private payers and how they differ from Medicare. I know you're excited about this, and I'm excited about this. When Medicare Advantage got permission from the federal government this year to basically interpret state by state how they interpret what an essential health benefit is, which means they now might be able to, Medicare Advantage has the right to say, hey, we will pay for assisted living. We will pay for non-medical home care. But when you ask why, what motivated this change, it was technology. Okay. And I've asked that. And I've asked, and I said, say, what were you thinking? They say, oh, we're thinking iPads. Grandma can take an iPad home and, you know, we can manage it from there, or a Bluetooth scale, things like that, which traditionally Medicare didn't pay for. So the Medicare Advantage plans are now saying, hey, we will do that. So to me, that's really what drove this was technology. But I always use two examples, Gavin. Number one, the insurance companies have been doing this for years. So when all these new innovations came about since the ACA, the insurers go, hey, wait a minute. We've always been an insurance model. We've always been incentivized to keep people healthy and at home. So your new technology really isn't that new to us. We've been seeing examples of this for years, and we actually already have some. So unless yours is significantly better, we're just going to take a pass for now. So that's number one. The other example I use is, having been a hospital CEO overseeing 500 employees at times, I can say this truthfully, but with a laugh, that it's hard enough to get my own employees to do what I ask them to do. And now with technology, I have to count on either, for telehealth, for example, somebody else's employee that doesn't report to me to have a competency to understand the technology, and also to be on the other end of that technology at the exact same moment with the understanding of what I'm going to ask them to do. That's a lot to ask. That is a lot to ask. We didn't even factor in yet the patient.
Yeah.
And you know, Dr. Coleman, who we mentioned earlier, and somebody we both look up to, has always been a big advocate of, look, this all comes down to self-management. This comes down to patients being educated, being willing to do it. We can throw all these other things in place, whether they're technology or not. But until the patient's willing to engage, and for those of you who have seen my new book, Health Well, that's really the point of the whole book, is we all have to become engaged health consumers, not just when we're senior citizens, Gavin, but right now. We're going to keep paying more and more every year, whether it's your business or your family, for healthcare until we engage in the process. And that's just another way to say self-management.
Well said. I agree with the self-management. The patient has to be engaged. So the last part of our show today, we'll talk briefly about Health Wealth and how folks can learn more about you, Josh. But before we do, going back to technology, I saw you on your email from your phone earlier today while we were prepping for the show. And what app on your smartphone could you not live without or would impact your life the most?
Well, I think if you thought about this for a second, you know the answer. But over the last couple of years, I've been blessed to become an influencer on LinkedIn to the point that I've engaged with LinkedIn. I was one of the keynote speakers at the Masters of LinkedIn Summit, the first one in Los Angeles. And actually, what I'm most proud of on LinkedIn, and I'm at Dr. Josh Luke on LinkedIn, so if you don't follow me already, please do, and I'll follow you back. We also have a group called Health Wealth, employer group for reducing spending on healthcare. But at drjoshluke.com, what I try to do daily is to post a lot of short-form media. And a lot of people are against that, Gavin, but what short-form media translates to is when Gavin or the Pop Health Podcast or Zach puts out a piece of material that I think has value, I share it. And some people are like, oh, he's gravy train. No, I don't gravy train. I think you know that. What I do,
gravy train.
Riding on your coattails, riding on your back. I think that might be a Jim Rome term there. But but what I do, and I've seen most growth from taking Gavin's stuff and by saying, hey, I want to share this with you. And here's the two or three sentences that really stood out to me. And for your stuff and the Pop Health stuff, it's always positive. Like, hey, this was a great story. And I think what it does is it shows people that I respect you and that you're also a thought leader. But it also says, here's Josh's truth filter and his truth meter. And here's what he thinks is most relevant for us to look at. And as you know, I probably do like a 70% on other people saying, I don't believe this, or I'm calling baloney on this, and here's the hole in this story. But the 30% where I say, hey, this is a great article, please read it, take a look at this interview, whatever it might be, those two or three sentences, which they refer to as short form media, which is a share instead of a story, have really built my following. I increase by about 30 followers a day right now without really, I can't connect anymore. One thing you might not know about LinkedIn is that 30,000 connections, I can't ask you to follow me anymore.
Okay.
So it really becomes subscriber based. You have to want to follow me. So I get about 25 to 30 a day. And here's what's cool. I lose one or two a day. Now, LinkedIn, I started probably 15 years ago when I was a young hospital and healthcare executive. Okay. So people that are unfollowing me now, I'm actually glad for that, because what I'm doing is building a subscriber base of people who are interested in reading the things that I'm an expert on. And over time at 30 followers a day, that grows, which is why I'm almost up to 37,000. And look, that doesn't matter. I have friends at 300,000. I don't want to be them. I want the 40,000 people who want to log on and see what I have to say that day about what's going on about healthcare affordability. So LinkedIn is the app I can't live without. Be patient with me if you send me something, because sometimes it's worse than email. It takes a few days to get back to you. But Gavin, one of the things I'm doing is the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative's last event is going to be in October of this year. And the reason is the event landscape's changed significantly. There's so many events now, it's hard to set yourself apart. There's been so much discussion about readmissions and care coordination that really there's not a whole lot new we can share with you. But the most important thing is your email firewalls at your companies and at Google and Yahoo are preventing any email that you're not familiar with from getting through. And so what we used to be able to do, send out a couple thousand emails to healthcare executives and say, hey, we're going to be in town, come see us. And people would pay $100 to come see us. We'd pack the house. Nowadays, it's hard to get even 100 people in the room. And so we've said, hey, let's move on to something where there's still value. And so what I'm going to be doing in 2019 is what we call intensives. And I've attended a couple of intensives, and they're 10 people or less, and they're focused on a very hyper-focused issue. And the first one, as you know, is about how to sell to hospitals. And what's cool about this, Gavin, is that I get to learn from the 10 people there as well. We're going to talk about some really kind of, I don't know if top secret's the right word, but high level things. And I'll give you a taste of one of them right now. California, really difficult market to sell in. Really difficult, fragmented hospital market. We have been doing value-based care for years off and on. It didn't work right. And now we're back to doing it again. But what I share with clients who call me and say, hey, can you help us? I say, stay out of California. In fact, I say, only focus on not-for-profits. And there's a reason why I say that. There's something called a community needs assessment that you could Google right now on any not-for-profit hospital, and you could know what their goals are. Whether those goals are true or not, I can't say that, but they've publicly gone on the record every 3 years and says, this is what we are going to do for our community to keep our tax status as a not-for-profit hospital. And there's a couple other factors that as a salesperson you go, oh my goodness, even after that, that separate a not-for-profit from other hospitals. And we're going to dig deep into that at this first intensive in Los Angeles on selling to hospitals. But what I'm excited about, and Gavin, I don't know if they'll work or not, but you know me well enough to know what I'm passionate about. I'm going to do a monthly intensive. One's going to be on how to be a social media influencer. The next one's going to be on how to write a best-selling book. And I've been blessed. I have two of those on Amazon now. And another one's going to be how to become a public speaker. And what I love about the intensives is they're a lot more expensive because you have to pay, you know, for the rate for the day and the marketing and the venue. But what I love about it is the people who are willing to spend between $500 and $1,000 a day to spend time with me to learn about that obviously value my input, but also are very committed to doing it. And so these intensives are kind of the new event, but they're much smaller. They're limited to 10 people. So it's really the start of a relationship in many cases, or the continuation of a relationship in others.
Very good, Josh. Well, appreciate you being on the show today. Dr. Josh Luke has been on our show. And folks, if you don't know how to connect with Josh, Josh, how do folks connect with you?
You can go to health-wealth.com is where you can find most of my information. We covered the NRPC website earlier. I'm on LinkedIn every day at Dr. Josh Luke. And you can also, if you're interested in having me come speak, which again is really my main source of income, you can go to drjoshluke.com. So Gavin, thanks so much for having me. I just want to thank you and Zach and the whole team at the Pop Health Podcast. One of my favorite podcasts. It's really advanced this agenda. And as I kind of am moving more into healthcare affordability and kind of splitting my time between care coordination and Pop Health and now healthcare affordability, it's great to know that there's people out there that are as educated or more educated than me on this topic like you guys. And I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Josh. Great having you again on the show, and we look forward to seeing you in Oakland in a few weeks.
Thanks so much.
All right, everyone. Well, if you enjoyed today's show or other shows of ours, feel free to leave a review on iTunes and Stitcher. That helps with visibility of the show and get great guests like Dr. Josh Luke. You can also contact myself or Zach by visiting pophealthpodcast.com. You can see contact information down below. You can also follow us on Twitter. Thanks, everyone. Take care.